Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's Greatest Briton is Enoch Powell, and this is the second part in a four-part series. My co-host is Max Musson from Western Spring, and today we will be looking at the Rivers of Blood speech.
As far as Winston Churchill is concerned, he did actually make a number of statements, which I think can quite obviously be regarded as racist, but he was a man of his time, and the vast majority of people in Britain during the early part of the 20th century and through to probably around about the 1970s did hold views very similar to the views that Churchill expressed. So it should come as no surprise that Churchill held these views. If I just read you some of the things that I've sort of picked out of the newspapers today, he once said, I don't know quite why he did, he must have been frustrated at the time, but he once said that he hated people with slit eyes and pigtails. To him, they were, the people of India were the beastliest people in the world. He said that he didn't really think that black people were capable or were as capable or as efficient as white people. He stated that he thought that the white man was superior and was conquering the primitive dark-skinned natives. He said that as an MP, he demanded a rolling program of more conquests based on his belief that the Aryan stock is bound to triumph, apparently. His doctor, Lord Moran, apparently once said that Winston thinks only of the colour of their skin. In 1937, he told the Palestine Royal Commission, "I do not admit for instance that a great wrong has been done to the Red Indians of America or the black people of Australia. I do not admit that a wrong has been done to these people by the fact that a stronger race, a higher grade race, a more worldly wise race, to put it that way, has come in and taken their place." In one infamous memo, he stated, "I am strongly in favour of using poison gas against uncivilised tribes." He admitted that he did not really think that black people were as capable or as efficient as white people. I mentioned that one earlier. In 1943, US Vice President Henry Wallace challenged Churchill's notion of Anglo-Saxon superiority. Churchill says here in this news transcript, "who drank quite a bit of whiskey," as Wallace wrote, gave a blunt reply. According to Wallace's diary, he said, "Why be apologetic about Anglo-Saxon superiority, that we were superior, that we had a common heritage, which had been worked out over centuries in England and had been perfected by our constitution." And Churchill apparently even appeared to blame the Indians for the famine that occurred in 1943, claiming that they bred like rabbits. And apparently he referred to Mahatma Gandhi, stating, "It is alarming and nauseating to see Mr. Gandhi, a seditious Middle Temple lawyer, now posing as a fakir, striding half naked up the steps of the Vice Regal Palace." Churchill said of his anti-colonialist adversary in 1931, "Gandhi should not be released on account of a mere threat of fasting." Churchill told the cabinet on another occasion, "We should be rid of a bad man and an enemy of the empire if he died." And from Churchill's book, The River War, he wrote, "How dreadful are the curses which Mohammedanism lays on its votaries, besides the fanatical frenzy which is as dangerous in a man as hydrophobia, that's rabies, is in a dog. There is this fearful fatalistic apathy. Improvident habits, slovenly systems of agriculture, sluggish methods of commerce, and insecurity of property exist wherever the followers of the prophet live." So he made quite a number of statements there which are undeniably racist, if indeed he did make them all. I don't really doubt that he probably did, because he was known to be a person who said things very often for effect, in order to achieve the aims and ambitions that he had. I mean, he once wrote in an article for the Illustrated Sunday Herald, and this is in February 1920, which is entitled, the article was entitled "Zionism versus Bolshevism." He wrote, "This movement among the Jews is not new. From the days of Spartacus Weishaupt to those of Karl Marx and down to Trotsky, Bela Kun, Rosa Luxemburg and Emma Goldman, this worldwide conspiracy for the overthrow of civilization and for the reconstitution of society on the basis of arrested development, of envious malevolence and impossible equality has been steadily growing. It has been the mainspring of every subversive movement during the 19th century, and now at last this band of extraordinary personalities from the underworld of the great cities of Europe and America have gripped the Russian people by the hair on their heads and have become practically the undisputed masters of that enormous empire. And so clearly not only did Churchill hold racist views, but he held views, as some of the people who are criticising him, which are little different from the kind of views that Hitler held and that Hitler expressed in Mein Kampf and in his other writings and his speeches. And this is a point that I would like to make, that a lot of people condemn and criticise the patriotic right in this country. They accuse us of being Nazis. And they state, you know, my father fought in the Second World War against people like you. And those sort of statements are made. But in reality, our fathers didn't fight in the Second World War against people like me. They fought in the Second World War following a man who had views that were very little different from the views of Adolf Hitler. They fought for Winston Churchill because Winston Churchill was British and because they wanted to defend the British power, and they wanted to defend the British Empire as a world power at the time, and they wanted to defend Britain against the rising threat that was being posed to Britain by Nazi Germany. They weren't fighting against those views, they were fighting for Britain's position entirely in accordance with the kind of views that I've just been reading out that were held by Winston Churchill. And so when people refer back to the Second World War as if the Second World War was a crusade against nationalism or a crusade against Nazism, that wasn't the case at all. It was a crusade by the people of the Allied countries in order to preserve and in order to further their own patriotism and their own nationalism. It wasn't against nationalism at all. And so the fact that in the modern era, people such as myself and yourself hold views that are patriotic and that are nationalistic is not out of place at all. It's actually in keeping with what has been the traditional patriotism that's existed in this country since time immemorial.
It's the views of our ancestors. I mean, we're told today that we were fighting to uphold democracy. No, we weren't. We were fighting against the Germans. We weren't fighting against National Socialism. We were fighting against the Germans because we had been told that the Germans wanted to invade Britain and the Germans wanted to take over the world and all this other nonsense that we know wasn't true. All Hitler wanted to do was expand into the East because he saw that America had a huge country. He saw that Britain had all these colonies. He saw that France had all these colonies. Germany didn't have any colonies. And there was this land to the East that was relatively uncivilized that would have really benefited from German ingenuity and German engineering. And that was what he wanted to do. And there was this big threat in the East as well from Bolshevism that was threatening the rest of Europe. And thanks to Hitler going into Russia, it arrested the advance of the Bolshevism into Western Europe. Unfortunately, at the end of the war, Bolshevism, well, it was just handed over to Bolshevism, wasn't it? The Baltic countries and the Balkans and a lot of the East and Poland and all these countries that we've been told that we were liberating, they were just handed over to Stalin. There was no battle of the ideologies here, and the British people just thought that they were defending their country, and they would have, if they had actually listened to translations of what Hitler was saying, they would have realised that he was just talking a lot of common sense and a lot of the ideas that the British people had anyway. Why should you apologise for being superior? And we were superior in strength and in battle and in technological prowess, and we defeated these lesser peoples that didn't have such good weapons, that didn't have gunpowder, that didn't have guns. And once we had defeated them, we gave them our civilization. It's not like we enslaved them once we had defeated them, or we genocided them, which is what these other peoples were used to doing. As you pointed out earlier, Max, you know, when they would have a battle, when they would have a war, they would either enslave the defeated or they would wipe them all out. And we never did that. Once we had defeated them, we would imprison the leader, or we would kill the leader. And we would say, now we're the leader, and we will enforce law and order. And we will have British law in this country, which means that you will be safe to go about your business. And the natives were very pleased with that, that once they had leaders, people that were ruling over them, that actually had a system of morals and didn't believe in might was right, but actually believed in justice. And that's what the British people believed in. I mean, as we've looked at some of these characters from the British Empire, they were the most upright, most moral people that you could think of, that put other people's needs before their own. I mean, Churchill was not a good example of that. He put his needs before anybody else. But as far as his views on race and Anglo-Saxon supremacy are concerned, they were the views of everybody at that time in America and also in Britain. I don't know if you want to add any more to that, Max, or should we get into Enoch Powell?
No, I think we've spoken enough about that. Yes, I think we can get on to Enoch Powell now, yes.
Let's get into our Greatest Britain then, because this is talking about this very time. I do find it fascinating looking back at the British Empire and the end of the British Empire, and looking back at history from a nationalist viewpoint. I've been learning so much from doing this series. I hope our listeners are learning a lot from this as well. We'll begin with a summary of what we've covered so far on our Greatest Britain, Enoch Powell. Powell worked for intelligence during the war and was suspicious of America's designs on the British Empire, seeing them as a greater threat than either Germany or Japan. He went to India, preparing for his life's aim of becoming Viceroy of India, where he was promoted to Brigadier, becoming the youngest Brigadier, like he had earlier been the youngest professor in the Commonwealth, and telling a colleague that he expected to be the head of all military intelligence in the next war. After returning to England, his ambition to be viceroy was crushed when he learned that the greatest prize of the empire had been lost. India was to be granted independence. So he entered into politics, strongly of the opinion that Britain should now give up pretending to be one of the world powers. That accolade now belonged to America and the newly formed USSR. And the USSR, as you pointed out last week, was the real winner out of the Second World War. That was the new world power that took the place that Britain had before the war. And he discovered that he had a talent for speaking when he gave a speech in Parliament lamenting the loss of the word British in the wording to the Statute of Westminster, and also the loss of Britain's claim to 9 separate territories in the Commonwealth. So it was really that really marked the end of the British Empire at that point when he gave this speech. Do you want to add anything to that, Max? Got any comments you'd like to make on that?
No, I think that's a very accurate thing. I mean, as far as the Soviet Union is concerned, I don't know that the Soviet Union necessarily replaced Britain from the previous power structure that existed internationally. What happened was that the Soviet Union occupied the space that the Germans wanted to occupy, in that they had that they dominated Central and Eastern Europe, and also they. If you look at the Asiatic part of Russia, they controlled what was called the hinterland. I can't think who the author of Geopolitics was, but the hinterland is the sort of the bulk of the Eurasian landmass, and if you control, it's believed by people who advocate geopolitics that the nation that controls the bulk of the Eurasian landmass, the hinterland, is the force that will eventually dominate the world. And so what we've got is a situation now where the USSR took the place of Germany, because the Germans, if we'd left them to their own devices, they would have just pressed further eastward, and in view of the fact that they wouldn't have to form a Western front against Britain and America, they could have put all of their forces on the Eastern front, and then they almost certainly would have then overwhelmed the Russian armies and the armies of the USSR, and they would have then pushed certainly as far as the Urals and perhaps beyond the Urals, and perhaps would have conquered the entirety of what is today the USSR, and they would have then occupied the position currently held by the USSR. But that wasn't the case. Britain and America declared war against the Germans, so the Germans lost the Second World War, but it then enabled the Russians to take the place and to be this world power that occupied a great chunk of the European landmass, but also the vast bulk of the hinterland in Central Asia. And so that this was the realization that Enoch Powell made, was that we were now faced with a situation where America, because of its economic power, and Russia, or the USSR, because of its domination of the hinterland, they were now the two world powers, and that Britain was almost irreversibly weakened by the fact that we had fought on the winning side during the Second World War, but had, in order to do that, that we had bankrupted ourselves as a nation in standing alone against Germany for so long.
You can understand why Britain went into that war when it's explained like that, because the fear was that Germany was going to have all of that, and Germany was going to be this big empire. So if we go to war, then it will be the Soviets, and the Soviets aren't going to be nearly as technologically advanced and nowhere near the powerhouse that the Germans are. So I think that may have played into it. And at the end of it, we ended up with an American empire and a USSR, which was the size of an empire. I mean, a huge landmass that it was controlling, and then just the tiny little island of Britain, a terrible state of affairs.
And it's also interesting that the world power that's currently sort of coming to the fore is China. And as far as China is concerned, not only do they control the far eastern parts of China, but they also control the vast areas of Central Asia, or vast areas of Central Asia, where they are up against the Uyghurs, effectively. And so therefore the Chinese are dealing with the Uyghurs fairly sort of ruthlessly, because by cementing their control of part of the hinterland, they are asserting their claim to be a world power. And so what we can see as far as Asia is concerned is a certain amount of tension between what is today Russia and China, in terms of their them sharing the hinterland. And it will be interesting to see how that game plays out.
Yeah, they seem to work together with the various things, that, like the Belt and Road Initiative and the Shanghai Cooperation thing, or whatever it's called. Russia and China do seem to get on quite well, because both of them were originally communists. And of course, Enoch Powell was really interested in all of this geopolitics, as we'll see as we get further on into his life. But back in 1957, which is where we are here, when Harold Macmillan replaced Anthony Eden as Prime Minister, Powell was offered the office of Financial Secretary to the Treasury. This office was for the Chancellor of the Exchequer's deputy, and it was the most important position there was outside the Cabinet. But in January 1958, he resigned, along with the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Peter Thornycroft, and his Treasury colleague, Nigel Birch. And this was in protest at government plans for increased expenditure, because he was a staunch advocate of disinflation, or in modern terms, a monetarist and a believer in market forces. The byproduct of this expenditure was the printing of extra money to pay for everything, which Powell believed to be the cause of inflation, and in effect a form of taxation, as the holders of money would find that their money was now worth a lot less. He was correct, and inflation rose to 2.5%, a high figure for the era, especially in peacetime. During the late 1950s, Powell promoted control of the money supply to prevent inflation, and during the 60s was an advocate of free market policies, which at the time were seen as extreme, unworkable, and unpopular. In his 1958 resignation over public spending and what he saw as an inflationary economic policy, he anticipated almost exactly the same views that during the 1980s came to be described as monetarism. And of course, he's quite correct here. If you print lots of money, you are going to cause inflation, and you do need to have control over the money supply. The banks should not have this control over the money supply. he was quite ahead of his time, I think, thinking this. Max, you know a fair bit about the economy and the finances and the rest of it. What are your thoughts on this?
Yes, I think Enoch Powell was absolutely correct. There are two ways in which a government can increase the money supply in a country. One way is that they can actually print more pound notes, which increases the money supply, but doesn't increase the indebtedness of society and the government. But by increasing the money supply, you are therefore increasing the demand for products. And so therefore, the price of products goes up because of one of the fundamental principles of economics, that if there is a greater demand for something, then the price of it will go up. And so that in itself of printing money into the very principle of printing money and spending that into the economy will create inflation. The other way of increasing the money supply, as far as the country is concerned, is through using the fractional reserve banking principle, where money is borrowed into the economy. And this is a concept which is probably too complicated to explain over the radio. But effectively, what happens is that governments create more money by issuing loan certificates that are called government bonds. And through issuing these, the government acquires greater spending power. But at the same time, it also acquires government debt. And so this is the principle that exists at the moment, which causes not only inflation, but also increased government debt. And so Powell was correct, really, in identifying uncontrolled government spending as a cause of inflation. But the other thing that he should have focused on as well is the fact that through fractional reserve banking, not only was there inflation caused, but there was increased government debt caused as well. And the traditional weakness in Powell's argument and the monetarism that has been pursued by people like him since the 1950s and onwards is the fact that they have not identified fractional reserve banking as being the cause of not only of inflation but also of increased government debt as well, and the increase in government debt is just as dangerous for an economy as the inflation that's caused by printing more money. There really needs to be a system adopted whereby the money supply in a country is either relaxed, or control over the money supply is either relaxed or tightened in response to the amount of inflation that exists within society. And if a mechanism was set up, and there's no reason why a mechanism couldn't be set up, and the mechanism that would need to be set up would be, to use an analogy, very similar to the kind of mechanism that exists in an engine that's got a fuel injection system, where the fuel injection system has sensors in place to detect when the fuel supply to an engine is becoming either too rich or too weak, and so therefore it then restricts or increases the amount of fuel getting through to the engine. And so a system of reporting just needs to be established within a country whereby inflationary factors are reported back to a central body that can then either restrict or increase the supply of money into the economy. And if a system such as that existed, then inflation could be, as a menace to society, could be completely eradicated. And in that respect, Powell was right. But where the monetarists went wrong is that they applied a simple principle of whenever the money supply was getting out of control, then they advocated increasing interest rates. By increasing interest rates, what that does is that means that those people that hold the debt where money is borrowed into existence, they receive far more interest than they otherwise would have done.
And what you end up with that is the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. So it was good of him to point this out and point out the solution, but his solution was no good either. I think if they did ever come up with a mechanism like the one that you described, Max, they'd hide it. They don't want a mechanism like that. They want there to be this inflation and increased interest rates. I mean, they've got, look at the interest rates at the moment. It's at naught, isn't it? And they're deliberately crashing the economy. They don't want the economy to function properly. It's that's not a part of the system that we have today. But yeah, he was really interested in the economy, and he stayed interested in that for the rest of his life. But on the 27th of July, 1959, Powell delivered a speech about what happened at the Hola camp of Kenya, where 11 of the most hardcore Mau Mau terrorists were killed after refusing to join the rehabilitation process and work in the camp. Powell noted that some MPs had described the 11 as subhuman, and he responded by saying, "In general, I would say that it is a fearful doctrine which must recoil upon the heads of those who pronounce it, to stand in judgment on a fellow human being and to say, because he was such and such, therefore the consequences which would otherwise flow from his death shall not flow." Powell also disagreed with the notion that because it was in Africa, different methods were acceptable, saying, "Nor can we ourselves pick and choose where and in what parts of the world we shall use this or that kind of standard. We cannot say we will have African standards in Africa, Asian standards in Asia, and perhaps British standards here at home. We have not that choice to make. We must be consistent with ourselves everywhere. All government, all influence of man upon man rests upon opinion. What we can do in Africa, where we still govern and where we no longer govern, depends upon the opinion which is entertained of the way in which this country acts and the way in which Englishmen act. We cannot, we dare not, in Africa of all places, fall below our own highest standards in the acceptance of responsibility." Dennis Healy, a Member of Parliament from 52 to 92, later said that this speech was the greatest parliamentary speech I ever heard. It had all the moral passion and rhetorical force of Demosthenes. And the Daily Telegraph report of the speech said that, "As Mr. Powell sat down, he put his hand across his eyes. His emotion was justified, for he had made a great and sincere speech." Again, I think this really sums up the mentality in the British Empire. Even in the worst places, the most uncivilized places, we have to show the highest of standards. And that is the most important place for us to show that we still have these high standards and set a good example. So he was doing a really good thing here, I think. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
Oh, just that is a first class example, really, of what you were saying earlier on, of the way in which the British people who went out into the British Empire to be administrators of the British Empire, the fact that they had these very high ethical standards and that they tried to apply the benefits of those high ethical standards to the people that were under their control.
Yeah, there was no, we treat them differently to how we treat ourselves. I mean, it's gone a little bit too far now. We do too much for everybody else and not enough for ourselves. But back then, I think it was just about right. Well, Powell returned to the government in July 1960 when he was appointed health minister, although he did not become a member of the cabinet until 1962. During the thalidomide scandal, he could have shown more sympathy for the victims, refusing to meet with them and resisting calls for a public inquiry. However, he did do well in beginning the debate on psychiatric institutions and resisting the dumping of the inmates into the community. He claimed the criminally insane should never have been released and that the problem was one of funding. He said the new way of caring for the mentally ill would cost more, not less, than the old way, because community care was decentralised and intimate and being described at the time as more human. But his successors had not provided the money for local authorities to spend on mental health care, and therefore institutional care had been neglected, while at the same time there had been no funds forthcoming for community care either. So this care in the community and putting the criminally insane in the community, that didn't work. It also caused lots of people to be hurt. I'm a bit disturbed to hear that he didn't have much sympathy for the thalidomide victims. Do you know anything about that, Max? What went on in that time in the 60s with thalidomide?
No, I've got no knowledge of that. But it's clear that during the early 60s, Enoch Powell had already realised that the damage that would be done to our society by care in the community, and that by closing down the institutions that previously looked after people who were in need of psychiatric care, that those people would be released upon society and would do untold damage. And it's just very saddening, really, that here we are 60 years later 60 years later, and still the present day government has not learned what Enoch Powell had realized back then, and that still we still release people who are irredeemable psychiatric cases into the community, and of course they go on to harm and in some cases kill again, and it's just very, very sad that Enoch Powell wasn't listened to then and that nobody's listened to him since.
They put the individual's needs above everything else, don't they? And they look at them as, oh, well, they are criminally insane, but they're individuals. You know, we have to put their rights above the rights of everybody else. It's an absolutely insane ideology. Now we get on to the immigration issue. During the 1964 general election, Powell said in his election address, "It was essential for the sake not only of our own people, but of the immigrants themselves, to introduce control over the numbers allowed in. I am convinced that strict control must continue if we are to avoid the evils of a colour question in this country, for ourselves and for our children." Norman Fowler, who was then a reporter for The Times, interviewed Powell during this election and asked him what the biggest issue was. "I expected to be told something about the cost of living, but not a bit of it. Immigration," replied Powell. "I duly phoned in my piece, but it was never used. After all, who in 1964 had ever heard of a former Conservative cabinet minister thinking that immigration was an important political issue?" After losing the election, he was made the Shadow Defence Secretary, and in a controversial speech on the 26th of May 1967, Powell criticised the UK's post-war world role, saying, "In our imagination, the vanishing last vestiges of Britain's once vast Indian Empire have transformed themselves into a peacekeeping role on which the sun never sets. Under God's good providence and in partnership with the United States, we keep the peace of the world and rush hither and thither, containing communism, putting out brush fires, and coping with subversion. It is difficult to describe, without using terms derived from psychiatry, a notion having so few points of contact with reality." And in 1967, Powell spoke of his opposition to the immigration of Kenyan Asians to the United Kingdom after the African country's leader Jomo Kenyatta's pro-Negro policies led to the flight of Asians from that country. So we're starting to see here that he's starting to wake up to the immigration issue. He's realizing that we're going to have the same problems over here in Britain that they had in America at the time. And why would we want to do this to ourselves? And he's also questioning what's happening with Britain now that we've lost the British Empire. Why are we still being expected to go around the world peacekeeping and solving all the problems? They're not our problems anymore. These countries have got independence. We should not be getting involved over there. And he even points out that this is, you know, a completely insane notion, having so few points of contact with reality. It's also good to see that he was opposed to these Asians coming over from Africa. That Yasmin Alibi Brown, she's one of these Asians that we gave refuge to, who absolutely hates white people and has devoted her life to basically criticizing and attacking the very people that gave her refuge from this Kenyatta, who is apparently quite a nasty character, from what I hear. I believe somebody in the National Front might have emptied a bucket of blood over him when he came over here on one visit, or maybe another one.
I think that might have been Martin Webster that did that.
Yeah, was it Kenyatta who did that too?
I'm not sure he emptied a bucket of blood. I think he lunged forward out of a crowd of people and punched Kenyatta on the jaw and knocked him to the ground, effectively. I think that's what it was.
Well, we can't really condone that sort of behaviour, but I guess it was more acceptable back then. Max, you got any views on this and Powell waking up to immigration?
Well, I think that I can't really say much more about Powell waking up to immigration at this point, other than to just, I've got a fairly vivid memory of reading A.K. Chesterton's The New Unhappy Lords, which is a great read for anybody that manages to find that book. But A.K. Chesterton was a a journalist during the 60s and 70s, and I'm not quite sure where he died, but he was a one-time leader of the National Front as well. But A.K. Chesterton wrote an article about the election in which Jomo Kenyatta was elected to be the leader of Kenya, and the point that in order that people would know who to vote for, the word Kenyatta means burning spear. And so this chap called Jomo decided to call himself Jomo Kenyatta because he adopted a burning spear as the symbol of his political movement. The other person who was fighting the election used the symbol of an elephant. And A.K. Chesterton recalls in The New Unhappy, Lords overhearing a group of Kenyans arguing about the pros and cons, the advantages and disadvantages of having a burning spear as opposed to an elephant, in order to decide who they were going to vote for. Also sort of notes that because the Jomo Kenyatta had promised the people of Kenya that they would all have freedom after the election, that large numbers of them, when they turned out to vote, carried a bucket with them so they could take home their freedom, not actually realizing what freedom was and thinking it was something that they could, something nice that they could collect in a bucket.
I guess a burning spear is better than a burning tire. The burning tire party, which we will get later on with Mandela. Well, now we get to the Rivers of Blood speech. The Birmingham-based television company ATV saw an advance copy of the speech on the Saturday morning, and its news editor ordered a television crew to go to the venue, where they did actually film sections of the speech, but there is no known copy of the entire speech that has become so famous. It's a great shame, that. Earlier in the week, Powell had said to his friend Clem Jones, a journalist and then editor at the Wolverhampton Express and Star, "I'm going to make a speech at the weekend, and it's going to go up fizz like a rocket. But whereas all rockets fall to the earth, this one is going to stay up." Powell was renowned for his oratorical skills and his maverick nature, and on the 20th of April 1968, he gave his speech in Birmingham, where he warned the audience of what he foresaw would be the consequences of continued unchecked mass migration from the Commonwealth into the UK. Above all, it is his allusion to the Roman poet Virgil towards the end of the speech which has most been remembered, giving the speech its colloquial name, the Rivers of Blood speech. He said, "As I look ahead, I am filled with foreboding. Like the Roman, I seem to see the River Tiber foaming with much blood, that tragic and intractable phenomenon which we watch with horror on the other side of the Atlantic, but which there is interwoven with the history and existence of the States itself, is coming upon us here by our own volition and our own neglect. Indeed, it has all but come. In numerical terms, it will be of American proportions long before the end of the 20th century. Only resolute and urgent action will avert it, even now. Whether there will be the public will to demand and obtain that action, I do not know. All I know is that to see and not to speak would be the greatest betrayal." The public loved it and thought, "Finally, a politician is taking notice of what is happening." But the Times declared it an evil speech, stating, "This is the first time that a serious British politician has appealed to racial hatred in this direct way in our post-war history." And the public really did love it. I mean, it went down really, really well. But the thing about this is, it was just so truthful. I mean, that is exactly what was going on. Everybody could see what was happening in America with the civil rights upsets and the riots and the trouble that they were having. And we didn't have the history that America had. We hadn't brought slaves to England to do the work. We didn't have any black people here to speak of until the end of the war. What were we doing importing these people into our country when we could see all the troubles that it had caused in America? An absolutely insane idea. And Enoch Powell was voicing this, and he united the public. You had the upper class people that supported him, you had the working class people that supported him, you had all the football supporters, that supported him. I mean, this made him massively popular, and it was, I believe it was last year, that we actually had more murders in London than we had in New York, which was another prediction that he made in this speech, that there would be as many murders here as there were in America. And there's been lots of TV programs where they attack this speech and they attack him, but they never actually attack him for the truth of it. They just call him names. They just say it's racist. He said the black man will have the whip hand over the white. Oh, how racist that is. Well, we have black people that are in Parliament, and that is the people that are in charge are in Parliament. And that's what he was referring to, the whip hand, the master, the guy that's in charge. And we do. We have black MPs. We have black chief of anti-terrorism police. We have non-whites in all parts of society, and that was what he was predicting. So for people to claim that this speech didn't come true, they can't do that. So all they can do is call him names and call him racist, which he denied that he was a racist. We've got some quotes that we'll probably get into next week on that. But what are your thoughts on this speech, Max? Do you remember it when he actually gave it and the noise it made?
Yes, I do remember that period very distinctly. I think it was quite clear that at that point in time, something like 85% of the British public supported what he said. And this was the reason why the Tory party was so frightened and why he was threatened by the Conservative government at the time. And Enoch Powell was, I mean, if you can imagine the kind of popularity with which Nigel Farage has been held from time to time, well, you know, Enoch Powell was Nigel Farage times 10. Edward Heath was greatly frightened by the fact that Enoch Powell had suddenly become this figure who was the man of the hour, so to speak. And so everything was done to shut Powell up. Powell at this particular point in time could, had he left the Conservative Party, had he resigned and formed his own political party, he could have swept the nation. There would have been a landslide victory for him at the next general election. And in my view, it is one of the greatest lapses of judgment in British history that Enoch Powell decided not to form his own political party at that point. Had he done so, the history of Britain since the late 60s would have been entirely different in this country. But that decision by him not to do that was cataclysmic in my view, in terms of the impact on the future welfare and well-being of the British people. I can remember at the time the leaders of the National Front offering to step down and to allow Powell to become the chairman of the National Front, and you know, that was an offer that was actually made to him at the time, and yet he turned that down. And so, you know, that's a great disappointment that he didn't seize the initiative at that key point in his career.
I think one of the incredible things about it is he had so much support, and yet he was universally slammed by the press. I mean, it points out that the Times attacked him here, but every single newspaper attacked him. Everybody on television attacked him, and yet the entire British public supported him so much. So, I mean, I still hear people in their 70s, in their 80s that aren't nationalists that talk about what a great politician Enoch Powell was. The first job that I had when I was 16, I can remember my boss telling me what a great man Enoch Powell was and how the country would have been completely different if he had been prime minister. I'd never heard of him, never heard of the guy. And yet, you just come across people talking about him throughout your life and you become interested in him, which is why I'm really pleased we're doing this series and going so into depth in what went on in the man's life, because he really was one of our very greatest of Britons. Well, let's get into our greatest Briton again then. We'll begin with a summary of where we've got to so far. Powell was Secretary to the Treasury, where he made a name for himself by being against the printing of money before becoming Health Minister, where he spoke against releasing the criminally insane into the community. He saw the importance of continuing to hold ourselves to high standards, regardless of whether we were in Britain or Africa, condemning the killing of Mau Mau terrorists, with the excuse being that they were less human than whites. He did not think we should be following America around, being the policeman of the world. Now that we no longer had the British Empire, we should have just left them to it. Far more important was the immigration problem, which he began to take notice of in 1964, warning that Britain was importing the same problems that were starting to take hold in America. In 1968, he made his famous Rivers of Blood speech, warning about what he could see happening to the country if unrestricted immigration continued, and the speech received massive public support, but was universally slammed in the press and by his fellow politicians. And I actually caught a glimpse of Enoch Powell on the television today, and he was saying that he was actually supported by 90% of the public. So there must have been a poll at the time that said 90% of the public actually supported him. Max, have you got any thoughts on that or anything else that comes to mind on that summary?
I think that's a good summary of what we've discussed. And yes, I was aware that there was overwhelming public support for him at the time. And as I said last time, it was something that was recognised, and lots of people were urging Enoch Powell to start his own political party. And as I said last week, had he the confidence to have done that and the determination to have done that, then British history since that point in time would have been considerably different from what it has been. But for whatever reason, and I don't know what the reason is, Enoch Powell decided not to form his own political party, and he preferred to become a member of parliament for a constituency in Northern Ireland. I think it was Antrim, and that to some extent, or to a great extent, marginalised him as far as his influence over British politics thereafter, which is a great shame. And he must have realised that doing that would marginalise him. It's just a shame, as I say, that he didn't have the confidence and the determination to take to confront the Conservative Party head on and to launch his own political party and change British history.
I think maybe he had this loyalty to the Conservative Party. I think that may have been the reason, even though he had been kicked out by them. Well, the main political issue addressed by the speech was not immigration as such, however. It was the introduction of the Race Relations Act 1968 by the Labour government at the time, which Powell found offensive and immoral. The act would eliminate the right to freedom of association under the disguise of prohibiting discrimination on the grounds of race in certain areas of British life, particularly housing, where many local authorities had been refusing to provide houses for immigrant families until they had lived in the country for a certain number of years. One feature of his speech was the extensive quotation of a letter he had received detailing the experiences of one of his constituents in Wolverhampton. The writer described the fate of an elderly woman who was supposedly the last white person living in her street. She had repeatedly refused applications from non-whites requiring rooms to let, which resulted in her being called a racialist outside her home and receiving excreta through her letterbox. When Heath telephoned Margaret Thatcher to tell her that he was going to sack Powell, she responded, "I really thought that it was better to let things cool down for the present rather than to heighten the crisis." But Heath did indeed sack Powell from his shadow cabinet the day after the speech, and he never held a senior political post again. Two things I find interesting about this. This removing of freedom of association, people don't very often think about that, but you used to be free to say, well, I want to sell my house to people like me. I don't want to have to sell my house to somebody non-white. And why should you have to? Why should you have to sell to somebody you don't want to sell to? Why should you have to employ somebody that you don't want to employ? That's what freedom of association is. It means you are free to associate and do business with whoever you want to associate with. So they did away with that. And also this bit where he points out this quotation of the letter he received. I mean, this is the same. This sort of thing still goes on today. I can remember talking to somebody who was one of the few remaining white people in the area, And this was the sort of thing that was going on. Dirt put through the letterbox and then being offered ridiculously cheap prices for the house. What they would do is they would make it impossible for the few remaining white people to live there any longer. And then they would insult them even more by offering them £10,000 for the house instead of £150,000. So, and this, as I say, this must have been going on back then, and it's still going on today. And the caricature that we see is of the nasty racist doing things like this, but it's not. It's the other way around, exactly as Enoch Powell detailed in this. Max, have you any thoughts on this, on those two pieces?
Well, just following on from what you're saying about about the degradation of areas once the immigrants started to move in. I mean, I lived in Luton during the early what would it have been? It would have been the mid to late 50s onwards. And I can remember, because my father was unable to drive a car, and he used to walk into Luton every Saturday, and I used to go with him most Saturdays, and we used to walk through Bury Park into Luton, and Bury Park is the main immigrant centre as far as Luton is concerned. And I can remember back in the 1950s that the people of Bury Park used to work very hard in order to maintain the quality of their buildings, etc. I can remember being fascinated by the fact that housewives would be on their hands and knees on the pavement outside their houses, polishing the step and lacquering the step and painting it and polishing their doorknobs so that their doorknobs shone brightly and so that their front doors were perfectly clean, and so that they've got this blacked shiny step for visitors to step over as they visited their house, and that in particular is something which sort of stuck in my head, as to the amount of effort that housewives went to in order to keep their houses looking presentable. It didn't take very long before the fabric of that area started to decline, and very often what happened was that houses wouldn't be properly maintained externally, and so that they would have paint peeling off, and the window frames would gradually become rotten. There would be all sorts of detritus dropped on the front gardens, etc. And this is a sign, again, as I said, of the dysfunctional aspects of a multicultural society.
It's a very common common accusation made against the non-whites, that they leave a lot of mess everywhere. And of course, the problem is, if you've worked very hard for something, you're going to look after it. If you haven't worked very hard for something, you've just been given it, you're not going to look after it so much. And you had the British people that had worked very hard to build these cities and build these towns and build these houses, and their ancestors have been there for years, so they're going to look after it. And then you've got a new people that come from somewhere else in the world that just suddenly arrive, and they're given a council house, and they're used to living in slums in Jamaica. They're not really going to look after the place. And of course, the white people that live there, they aren't going to want to import that into their street. They are certainly not going to want to sell their house to somebody that's going to move into the street and start dropping litter everywhere. I mean, the idea of housewives cleaning their steps and polishing the doorknobs, I mean, we just don't think of that today. And the reason why we don't think of that, the reason why we don't see that, is because standards have been lowered due to this immigration, due to importing people that didn't have the same standards as us. Everything always drops down to the bottom. It doesn't raise itself up to the top. It always goes to the lowest common denominator. It is such a shame. I'd love to live in a country today where people still polished their doorsteps and polished the doorknobs and took as much concern about where they were living outside as they do inside. Well, Powell received almost 120,000 predominantly positive letters, and a Gallup poll at the end of April showed that 74% of those asked about his speech agreed with his speech. and only 15% disagreed, with 11% unsure. So I guess you could say only 15% disagreed with his speech. 85% either agreed or were unsure. One poll concluded that between 61 and 73% disagreed with Heath for sacking Powell. And according to George L. Bernstein, many British people felt that Powell was the first British politician who was actually listening to them. After the Sunday Times branded his speeches racialist, Powell sued them for libel, but withdrew when he was required to provide the letters he had quoted from, because he had promised anonymity to the writer, who refused to waive it. Interesting there that the term used is racialist rather than racist. After the Rivers of Blood speech, Powell was transformed into a national public figure and won huge support all across the country. 3 days after the speech, on the 23rd of April, as the race relations bill was being debated in the House of Commons, 1,000 dockers marched on Westminster, protesting against the victimisation of Powell, with slogans such as, "We want Enoch Powell," and "Enoch here, Enoch there, we want Enoch everywhere." The next day, 400 meat porters from Smithfield Market handed in a 92-page petition in support of Powell amidst other mass demonstrations of working-class support, much of it from trade unionists in London and in Wolverhampton. Conservative politician Michael Heseltine stated that in the aftermath of the Rivers of Blood speech, if Enoch Powell had stood for leadership of the Conservative Party, he would have won by a landslide. And if he had stood to be Prime Minister, he would have won by a national landslide. I mean, that's incredible, isn't it? Michael Heseltine, because he must have been against him. The politicians were all pretty united in the fact that they were against Enoch Powell, the same as the press were. I'm interested in this term racialist, Max. Was the term racist being used back then? Did the term racialist, did it mean the same as racist now? Do you know the history of this term?
Some people during that era used to draw a distinction between the term racialist and racist, claiming that racist meant that you were somebody who hated people of another race, whereas racialist was a term used to describe somebody who acknowledged that there were racial differences but didn't necessarily hate people of a different race. I think that was the way things were, yes.
So he's been accused of being a racialist there. I would have thought he would have agreed with that and said, well, yes, I do agree there are differences between the races. I mean, otherwise you'd be lying about what your eyes see and your ears hear. But he didn't.
I think some people use the term racist and racialist to mean the same thing. And that probably would have been people on the left. I think as far as Powell is concerned, Powell would have. I'm pretty sure I can remember reading a book where, and I would again think it was Enoch Powell, tried to draw that distinction between racialist and racist, claiming that racist meant racial hatred, somebody practiced racial hatred, whereas racialist was somebody who merely recognized the differences between the races. So it may be that the newspaper confused the issue, and that they were accusing Powell of being a race hater rather than somebody who recognized racial differences.
Yeah, you can imagine the left conflating the two together as well. Answering David Frost on whether or not he was a racialist, Powell said, "It depends on how you define the word racialist. If you mean being conscious of the differences between men and nations, and from that races, then we are all racialists. However, if you mean a man who despises a human being because he belongs to another race, or a man who believes that one race is inherently superior to another, then the answer is emphatically no." And that's interesting with there, where he says, well, one race is inherently superior to another, because obviously you are going to believe that your own family is the best. You're going to believe that your own family is better than the other families, and that's subjective. But no family is actually inherently superior to another. So I think he's made a very good answer there about race being inherently superior to another. So you know, I don't believe any race is inherently superior to another, but I do believe my race is, because it's mine, because it's my family. At another speech in 1968, he was quoted as saying, "The West Indian or Asian does not, by being born in England, become an Englishman. In law, he becomes a United citizen by birth. In fact, he is a West Indian or an Asian still. And this is something that they will try to say today is wrong. They'll try to say that somebody black born in Yorkshire is a Yorkshireman. And then at the same time, they will go on about the ethnic heritage of these people. And we need to celebrate diversity, and we need to celebrate Diwali, and we need to celebrate these Muslim things. So they try to have it both ways. They try to say, well, they are British, and you can't say that they're not British. And then at the same time, they will tell them to be proud of their ethnic heritage. And for instance, like Sadiq Khan, and he will talk about how he's the first Pakistani mayor, and in Pakistan they were celebrating when he became mayor, and he will admit to that, and yet at the same time he will claim that he's a Londoner, and he's just as much a Londoner as anybody else. So I'm glad to see that we have Enoch Powell pointing this out in 1968. In 1996, the BBC was still attacking him and calling him a racist, to which he responded by saying, "What's wrong with racism? Racism is the basis of a nationality. Nations are, upon the whole, united by identity with one another, the self-identification of our citizens, and that's normally due to similarities which are regarded as racial differences." So again, he's saying there that this word racism has just become understanding that nations are different and nations are united by an identity with one another. Despite being kicked out of the cabinet by Heath, Powell's supporters claim that he contributed to the Conservatives' surprise victory at the 1970 general election, which showed a late surge in Conservative support. And in exhaustive research on the subject, the American pollster Douglas Schoen and University of Oxford academic R. W. Johnson believe it to be beyond dispute that Powell had attracted 2.5 million votes to the Conservatives. A February 1969 Gallup poll showed that he was the most admired person in British public opinion, and a 1972 Daily Express poll showed Powell to be the most popular politician in the country, yet the Conservatives had willfully turned their backs on him. It wasn't until 1974 that Powell would finally do the same to them, though, in response to the country joining the EEC without the Tories having a mandate to do so. And I think that there, that last bit, I think that explains why he didn't form his own party. I think he was still loyal to the Tories, even though they had stabbed him in the back, they'd sabotaged their own electoral success. I mean, it really does show you that the Conservatives are not interested in conserving anything. They are just there to distract the vote and to get people to vote for them instead of for a nationalist party. And all they're going to do is conserve the left-wing policies that were put there by the Labour Party. They're just a steam valve. They're just a pressure valve, a distraction. It's insidious, really, right, the way that it's become.
And you can see how, you know, you mentioned about what conservative politicians were saying about Enoch Powell at the time, Michael Heseltine, and you can see that during this period the Conservative Party would have been almost holding its breath and praying that Enoch Powell would facilitate them marginalising him and wouldn't form his own political party, because had he done so, then the Conservative Party would have been finished. And so it would have been a time of heightened tension, I would think, as far as the Conservative Party was concerned. And there must have been a lot of very heated arguments taking place behind locked doors as to, you know, what was the best way forward.
I think they were being led by the press as well. You know, the mainstream media has such amount of leverage over the government. I mean, we could see that with Dominic Cummings last year when they refused to talk about anything else for the entire week. But and we can't ignore the fact that the press were unanimous in denouncing Enoch Powell, and if the Conservative Party had have kept him on, then they would have been unanimous in denouncing the Conservative Party. They would have been calling the whole Conservative Party racist. They would have been doing the same as they're doing today to Patriotic Alternative. They would have been doing that to the Conservatives. I mean, it would have changed the course of history entirely if he had have formed his own party. Now, moving away from immigration for a moment, he was also very much against the European Union way back when it was called the EEC. Powell said the main problem with British membership in the EEC is that if there be a conflict between the call of the country and that of the party, the call of country must come first. Because Ted Heath voted for to join the EEC without actually having a mandate to do so. We have a quote here from Powell. He says, "Curiously, it so happens that the question, who governs Britain, which at the moment is being frivolously posed, might be taken in real earnest as the title of what I have to say. This is the first and last election at which the British people will be given the opportunity to decide whether their country is to remain a democratic nation governed by the will of its own electorate expressed in its own parliament, or whether it will become one province in a new European superstate under institutions which know nothing of the political rights and liberties that we have so long taken for granted." He went on to criticise the Conservative government for obtaining British membership, despite the party having promised at the general election of 1970 that it would negotiate no more, no less, and that the full-hearted consent of Parliament and people would be required if the UK were to join. He also denounced Heath for accusing his political opponents of lacking respect for Parliament, while also being the first Prime Minister in 300 years who entertained, let alone executed, the intention of depriving Parliament of its sole right to make the laws and impose the taxes of this country. He then went on to advocate a vote for the Labour Party, saying, "The question is, can they now be prevented from taking back into their own hands the decision about their identity and their form of government, which truly was theirs all along? I do not believe they can be prevented, for they are now, at a general election, provided with a clear, definite and practicable alternative, namely a fundamental renegotiation directed to regain free access to world food markets and recover or retain the powers of Parliament, a renegotiation to be followed in any event by a specific submission of the outcome to the electorate, a renegotiation protected by an immediate moratorium or stop on all further integration of the UK into the community. This alternative is offered, as such an alternative must be in our parliamentary democracy, by a political party capable of securing a majority in the House of Commons and sustaining a government." So he could really see what was happening here when the rest of the country, I'm not sure whether they did, the loss of sovereignty that happened by joining the EEC, and saying that Heath didn't have a mandate to do this. Was there a referendum at the time on this, Max? Do you know what was happening at this time when we joined the EU in 1970?
The referendum was after we had joined. It was roughly a year after we'd joined. So Ted Heath took us in, and then eventually the referendum took place. And again, the referendum was very, very similar to the... it was treated in the same way as the vote was for us to leave the European Union, where there was Operation Fear, and people were constantly bombarded with propaganda telling them that they would lose their livelihoods, that there would be mass unemployment, that all sorts of horrible things would happen if we didn't join the European Union, or didn't stay in the European Union, I should say. I believe from memory that all the employees of Sainsbury's were given the day off before the referendum, or it might have been longer than a day, but they were given time off with pay so that they could go and campaign for us to remain within the European Union. And it was a very sad occasion, when the result came through that the vote had been to remain within the Union. And there was a fair bit of speculation that first referendum had been fiddled as well, because of certain areas that were renowned for being particularly anti-European Union having voted for Britain to go into, to remain in the common market.
Yeah, it was a European Economic Community is the way that it was sold, wasn't it? It was just a way of us trading with Europe, and we weren't going to pay any taxes. But Enoch Powell had worked out that it was actually the loss of sovereignty, and from that moment on, the Parliament was our Parliament was not going to be able to make its own laws. And you know, that lasted for what, 30 years, 40 years, and Heath had no mandate to do this. As you say there, Max, he tried to have this get himself a mandate afterwards with a referendum after he'd actually carried out the deed. Well, this call to vote for Labour surprised some of Powell's supporters, who were more concerned with beating socialism than with the loss of sovereignty and national independence. On the 25th of February, he made a speech at Shipley, again urging a vote for Labour, saying he did not believe the claim that Wilson would renege on his commitment to renegotiation, which Powell believed was particularly ironic because of what he had seen of Heath's premiership. In acrobatics, Harold Wilson, for all his nimbleness and skill, is simply no match for the breathtaking, thoroughgoing efficiency of the present Prime Minister. At this moment, a heckler shouted, "Judas!" Powell responded, "Judas was paid! Judas was paid! I am making a sacrifice." Later in the speech, Powell said, "I was born a Tory, am a Tory, and shall die a Tory. It is a part of me. It is something I cannot alter." In 1987, Powell said there was no contradiction between urging people to vote Labour while proclaiming to be a Tory, saying many Labour members are actually quite good Tories. In an interview the next day, he said he would be voting for Helen Middleweek, the Labour candidate, rather than the Conservative Nicholas Budgeon. Powell did not stay up on election night to watch the results on television, and when he picked up his copy of The Times from his letterbox and saw the headline, "Mr. Heath's General Election Gamble Fails," he reacted by singing "Ta-dum." He later said, "I have had my revenge on the man who had destroyed the self-government of the United Kingdom." The election result was a hung parliament, as although the Tories had won the most votes, Labour had finished 5 seats ahead of the Conservatives. The national swing to Labour was 1%, with 4% in Powell's heartland, the West Midlands conurbation, and 16% in his old constituency, although Budgeon did win the seat there. According to the Telegraph journalist Simon Heffer, both Powell and Heath believed that Powell had been responsible for the Conservatives' loss at this election. So he was responsible for the win at the last one, and he was responsible for the Conservatives' loss at this one. And what do you make of him putting the needs of the country ahead of the party there, wasn't he? Something that he had referred to before, that you need to put the needs of the country ahead of the party, and that's why he was saying that people need to vote Labour. We need to get out of this EEC. What do you make of him saying that, Max?
Well, I can remember him doing that. I still think it's perhaps a shame then, from what you've been reading just previous to this, that it's clear that Powell was motivated to a great extent by getting revenge by sabotaging Heath's election. But it would have been so much better had he sabotaged Heath by starting his own political party. Perhaps it is a feature of the fact that we live in the internet age, where it would be possible to very quickly start a political party and very quickly get hundreds of thousands of people to join. Whereas during those days, there was no internet and there weren't even any mobile phones, I don't think, at that point in time. And so communication was that much slower. I mean, and that was one of the main reasons why Ted Heath was able to misrepresent the European Union for so great a length of time, and why politicians, you know, have over the decades of the sort of middle to late 20th century been able to misrepresent what the ultimate aims of the European Union are. And that was just purely because there was a monopoly on communication by the mass media, so television and newspapers, all controlled by a very small number of people, were able to censor out any information that the establishment political parties didn't want the British public to know. And the British public had no way, apart from word of mouth, to have found out different. Whereas nowadays, of course, information zooms around the world in a matter of minutes, and it would be impossible for, as it's been proven to be the case, it has been impossible for governments in recent times to hide what the ultimate aim of the European Union has been all along.
Much easier to expose it now, and much easier to manipulate the people back then. I guess the Brexit referendum result is just a testament to the fact that we do have ways that we can reach out to people now in ways that it just wasn't possible back then in 1970. Thank you very much for listening, and do tune in again tomorrow for another episode of Greatest Britons, which will be part 3 of our series on Enoch Powell.